shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The Talk of the Town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Welcome to the Nocturnal Journal here on WGN 720. We got a jam-packed show tonight. It's going to be a fast show in honor of Fast Eddie Ho, who we'll be talking about later. And we are going to go down to Skull's Rainbow Room in Nashville. But first of all, we're going to begin with Peter Guralnick, the author, 1994, Last Train to Memphis, and 1999, Careless Love, the two-volume biography of Elvis Presley. And then 2005, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, Dream Boogie. Those were huge books. He just came out with Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, 661 pages. I found it a little more breezy and a little more personal than his previous books. So listen in and see what Peter has to say. We're here with my very good friend, Peter Guralnick, who in November, I think it came out, the definitive biography, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Thanks for joining us tonight, Peter.
Always great to be with you, Dave. You know, I would be there in person if I could. And I hope to rejoin you many times in future.
Yeah, you should do that. Yeah. So I know of your work. I've known you forever. But tell me a little bit of the timeline of when you decided to do this book. I mean, I know you met Sam like in 79. But what how did you decide to jumpstart this project?
I don't know. You know, all the books that I've done, I mean, it's sort of like, when did I really begin? I know, for instance, when I first had the idea of doing a book on Sam Cooke, it was when I met J.W. Alexander in 1981 or 82, and I went there to interview him for Sweet Soul Music, because I thought Sam would just be Sam Cooke and Ray Charles, they were the progenitors of Southern soul music, gospel influenced. And I thought the story would be pat, which of course it never is. And I was just so entranced, I was so taken with J.W. Alexander, Sam Cooke's business partner, his friend, his mentor, and his mentee, that from that moment on, I knew I wanted to do something much more on Sam Cooke, but I wasn't writing biographies at that time, and so I don't know that I knew it. And I think that's the same with Sam Phillips. He was a subject of such a inspiration and abiding interest from the time I first met him in '79. That meeting I had with him, that first meeting, was as inspiring a meeting as anything I've ever had. Maybe I put Solomon Burke up there, you know, with Sam as being as charismatic a personality, but I don't know that I'm kind of like Sam Phillips in that respect. I mean, he said he heard all these, he could hear everything that was going on. He could hear the sound of the whippoorwill. He could hear the hose spading through the ground, maybe hitting a rock. He could hear, you know, people speaking harsh words and sweet words. He heard all these things. He prided himself on his hearing, but he didn't know what he was going to do with it. And I guess that's the case with me with Sam Phillips, was that I stayed in touch with him. I continued to interview him, particularly once I started work on the Elvis book. I always knew I wanted to do something great and grand and perfectly imperfect in Sam's terms, something that would not pay lip service to the linearity of the straight progression, of the straight narrative progression. But I didn't know what it was, and I guess, you know, I'd say off and on for the last 10 years I've been working on it. I mean, I started probably in earnest 7 or 8 years ago, but it goes back to that first meeting in 79.
What was it like for you? I mean, you did not know Elvis. You didn't know Sam Cooke. I mean, what was it like to write a book when you got to know your subject and how it informed your objectivity? I mean, what was it like? It was a different, it had to be a little bit of a different process for you.
I guess so. But I mean, you know, I've always wanted to tell the story from the inside out. And I felt that I found a way in. I mean, with Sam Cooke, for example, the way in was through the people who were closest to him, through talking to his brother L.C., the rest of his family, Bobby Womack, through talking to J.W. Alexander, through talking to Sam's wife, Barbara. They weren't people who were necessarily close to each other or altogether approved of each other. And yet when they spoke of Sam, they spoke in Sam's voice. And that was, so I felt like I had reached something with Sam. I had reached a way of seeing the Sam Cooke who was offstage, you know, the Sam Cooke, who, as Solomon Burke said, you know, Solomon said to me, who is Pete the writer when he's alone in his room at night? You know, that's what I always want to find out, you know, who is Dave Hoekstra? Who is Sam Cooke? Who is Sam Phillips? But with Sam Phillips, I mean, by knowing him, I had, I guess, a front row seat. And that was sort of, it was a shortcut in a way, but it wasn't any different than writing about Elvis or Sam Cooke. What made it different, in a sense, was not so much my insight into Sam Phillips, but the insights that it continued to force upon me about myself and the way in which I saw, because he lived a long life, but the last half of it, the last half of it had very little to do with what he was best known for, the music. Mm-hmm. And yet he continued to be as fascinating a character. And so I saw it as a much more anecdotal story once you were past the history that involves Elvis and Howlin' Wolf and Ike Turner and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis. And once you got past that, the story was no less fascinating. But I saw it as something that I wanted to tell it in a much more anecdotal fashion and tell it also in a way that gave plenty of room for character development, expansion, portrayal. But to do that, I had to use, or at least from the very beginning, I knew that I wanted to, I had to use myself. I had to use myself as a kind of, not as a character so much as a persona. I mean, I didn't want this to be, my breakfast with Sam, it wasn't my memoir, but it was just a way of gaining a purchase on describing somebody who was so complicated, so interesting, so original, and so individual, as he would say, in the extreme. And I wanted to give a portrait of that, and I was able to do that through my own, through the perspective I got through knowing him.
Was there a point of, you have such a great resume, was there a point of trust where, at the very beginning, where you... Like, when I interviewed Sam, it was in 87, and I kind of got in through the – I spent a couple hours with him at his house, and I kind of got into the John Prine connection. But still, Knox and Jerry took me out, and I remember one night they took me to the old Great Western Steakhouse. It's no longer there. And we ate a lot of meat and drank a lot of Jack Daniels. It was like I felt like I was on a test. And once I passed that test, then the gates opened. I mean, was there anything like that for you, or because you'd done the Elvis stuff and people knew you? I mean, was there a point of trust? You had to establish.
Well, I think, and don't forget, didn't the Western Steakhouse have a booth specially reserved for Elvis?
Yeah, they did.
Back on it or something.
And they also had musicians of stuffed squirrels behind the bar. They were all, like, one was playing a bass, the other was playing drums. I always remember that.
that's where I met Sputnik Monroe, one of them.
Oh, I love Sputnik, yeah.
And that's another way, it's another window into the world of Sam Phillips, who would rather spend his time with Sputnik Monroe, world's greatest wrestler, than, I don't know, name some Nobel Prize winner or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Or somebody who was pretentiously intellectual. I mean, so Sputnik was so smart. But as far as gaining Sam's trust was, he was not at all reluctant to, well, first of all, it took 10 years to get to interview.
Yeah.
I mean, he always considered the interview he did with me the first one that he had ever done outside of speaking to the Memphis newspapers. There was a great Robert Johnson at the Press-Symeter, who was really one of the best newspaper people of his time and wrote the best account of Elvis's early years. I mean, just a wonderful writer. And there were people like that whom Sam spoke to frequently, and he also spoke to the trades, to Billboard, to Cashbox. But he had no interest in doing interviews, and I met Knox almost 10 years before I met Sam, and we became very good friends. This is Knox, his older son.
Mm-hmm.
And Knox was trying that entire time to get me with Sam, but Sam thought it was kind of an act of perfidy, an act of, a violation of trust with the idea that you're always moving forward to look backward by doing an interview. And when I did the interview in 79, and there was a very different Sam Phillips that I met in 79 than the public one that he became from, the mid-80s on. I mean, he really embraced a public persona that was quite different from the person that I met. Not the real person was no different, but the persona was quite different. But he was not at all reluctant to share his philosophy with me, and that was what was so inspiring. I mean, when I met him that first time, he was the underpinning for the music. I knew why I was there. I knew how much I admired the music that he had created, the music that he had produced. But then he's telling me, basically, just a whole approach to life, which was so much in consonance with everything that I believed, was validated by what he was saying, and to think that this was what gave rise to the music. I mean, the idea that, everything is based on individualism, everything is based on the you know, on the individuate itself, on daring to be a nonconformist. If you, you know, if the country goes along or if people go along in the direction they're going now, this is in 79, it might just as well be said today, you know, in the direction if they give in more and more to the trend toward conformity, then, you know, we're going to lose our freedom. And, you know, in one of these days, we're just going to wake up in jail and not even know it. And, I mean, that was all encapsulated within the framework of talking about the music at that first meeting. And I thought, my God, this is just like, this is the person to follow for life.
We're going to take a break here for some spots, and I want to come back. I want to ask you, you were right on line of what I want to talk about life lessons from Sam, and then I also want to talk a little about Howlin' Wolf. So don't go away here on WGN's Nocturnal Journal. We're back here at Nocturnal Journal with the great Peter Guralnick and the author of Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, How One Man Discovered Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley, and how his tiny label Sun Records of Memphis revolutionized the world. It's on Little Brown Press. Pick it up. It's a great, great book. And it's a great book because what we were talking about before the break there is just – the life, it's the same reason, I know you're a baseball fan, the same reason I love Bill Vack and Mike Vack and stuff, the life lessons you can learn, the management lessons you can learn about dealing with people. The stuff, talk about like stuff like, if it wasn't fun, it wasn't worth doing. I mean, Sam really emphasized fun, you know. If you weren't doing something different, you weren't doing anything at all. Talk about his attitude and how that
is. And don't forget, you can be a rebel without being an outcast.
That's something I have to learn. I haven't mastered that yet.
A lesson for us all.
Yeah. But talk about how that attitude influenced his artists.
It influences, I mean, basically, Sam created a condition of freedom in the recording studio that is entirely different from any, not than most of the sessions that I've ever been at. Where basically, I mean, and I use these two examples on just because they're simple to understand. If Phil Spector is producing, you know, a session on somebody, if he were, you know, what the artist was doing a Phil Spector session, you were going to come out, you know, if it was Ike and Tina singing River Deep Mountain High, that was a Phil Spector production. It wasn't an Ike and Tina Turner song or record. It was a Phil Spector record. But I mean, in the same way, you think about somebody like Rick Hall, who's gotten so much deserved attention with this film Muscle Shoals, mm-hmm. and who, you know, is a unique individual, somebody I've known for 35 years, very much admire. But you go into his studio, you know, if you're Wilson Pickett, whoever you are, Etta James, he is going to get you to do the song the way that he hears it, the way that he imagines it. He's going to play it for you. He's going to sing it to you. He's going to do 39 takes. With Sam, you may get it on the first or second take. You may be the person, as the artist, like Carl Perkins, you may be the person begging him, or Warren, Warren Smith, or particularly Sonny Burgess. You may be the person begging him, but Mr. Phillips, let me do another take. That take had so many mistakes in it. And he's going to be saying to you, he says, no, that take had the feeling. I'll do another take if you want. I'll do another 10 takes if you want. But what he was looking for was feeling. He was looking for the pure expression of the feeling that resided within the artist and within the song. And that is what is so astonishing. And Carl Perkins, you know, told me, and I'm sure he told you, and he's, you know, told lots of people, about how Sam would get him to go out on a limb, and then he would not know how to get back from it. Mm-hmm. And how Sam, you know, again and again, he would go to Sam and he would say, Mr. Phillips, there was a mistake here, whether it was blue suede shoes or something else. I made all these mistakes here. Let me do it again. And the upshot was that Sam, you know, Sam saying to Carl, he says, that's what we are here at Sun. We're just one big inspired mistake. I mean, it's an amazing approach to art because it basically says you work with whatever hand you're dealt. Maybe that's the wrong word, work, but you deal with the hand you dealt.
Your book says, I mean, there was no failure in the studio. I mean, the ruptured speaker on Rocket 88, maybe we'll play some of that, but I mean, there was just never, it just didn't happen, right? He did go with whatever happened, right?
That was his point, and this was the philosophy, and this is the philosophy I wish I could live by, which is essentially, And this is what I try to teach when I, you know, in the classes that I've taught, the creative writing classes that I've taught at Vanderbilt. I mean, what I've tried to get across is there is no failure. There's only effort. Everything is a Sisyphean task. I don't know if Sam was into the myth of Sisyphus, but the point is you keep on, you know, pushing the rock up the hill. It keeps on landing on your head, but that's not a failure. You know, it hasn't crushed you yet. And Sam's point was he didn't want, I mean, forget about a song like Rocket 88, which in its own way is a masterpiece. Even if you went into the studio and your talent didn't sustain you, you didn't have the song like Rocket 88, you didn't have the feel, but if you put everything you had, Sam wanted you to walk out of that studio feeling like there was not a failure here. I did everything I could. I had fun in there. I recognize, you know, for instance, you said that about, you know, his idea of big fun. Everything had to be big fun. I wanted the book to be like that. I mean, that's why the book, in a way, is so different from any of the other books, is that I wanted to just explode the whole idea of narrative politeness.
In 87, he told me, he said he thought Howlin' Wolf had the worst voice he had ever heard, but then he stopped and he goes, it was so bad that it was magnificent. It contained all the raw beauty that everything I'd thought about in one man. Talk about his, I'd like to just touch on Wolf a little bit for our Chicago audience and stuff, but talk about his love of Howlin' Wolf, Chester Burnett.
Oh, Wolf was the absolute pinnacle of everything that Sam ever hoped for, ever
right.
did. I mean, if he could have, he didn't ever want it to be a one, you know, and a one artist label. That's one of the reasons he sold Elvis's contract. But if he had, if the one artist had been Howlin' Wolf, he would have been content to be a one artist label. I mean, he, you know, the famous quote is when he first heard Howlin' Wolf coming in on a bad connection from KWEM, where he was broadcasting on this noontime, you know, schedule. He said when he heard the music, he said that this is where the soul of man never dies.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, and I'll sign on for that. And you probably will too. I mean, there was no greater artist of any kind than Howlin' Wolf. And Sam always considered that he was the most profound artist that Sam had ever recorded. That the way in which, I mean, the first time that he induced Wolf to come into the studio, you know, he spoke to him on the phone. I guess he must have called him over at the station at KWEM in West Memphis. And he said, you know, why don't you stop by sometime, anytime. It doesn't, you know, he didn't want to put any pressure. He wasn't setting up a session. He wasn't doing anything, just trying to get him into the studio. And Wolf comes in with Willie Johnson on guitar and Willie Steele as drummer, and they start to playing. And Sam was so completely blown away. I mean, he said for one of the few times in his life he had absolutely no idea what to do. And he's in the studio, and he's adjusting the mics and moving them around. He says, but really, I wasn't doing anything. I could have just sat there forever listening to Wolf, watching him sit there, watching the intensity in that man's eyes, watching the soulfulness with which he communicated his music. And, you know, he said, I knew that to put the music together, I thought we'd want to add a piano, which he did on How Many More Years, you know, for the rhythm, and we'd want to do this. But as far as I was concerned, I could have lived like that for the rest of my life. And that's how great Howlin' Wolf was. And, you know, the one person, and I'm sure you know this, but the only person he ever compared to Howlin' Wolf in terms of that profundity or that ability to communicate the deepest down feelings within was Charlie Rich.
Yeah, right.
One person he put, and how could you find a more different, you know, musical sensibility? I mean, Charlie Rich was a jazz pianist. He was, you know, a very sophisticated musician. But Sam's point, I think, would have been, he said, Charlie wore his nerve endings on the outside, and you have the same feeling coming through in the music. And when Charlie sang You Don't Know Me, he said, oh, my God, nobody knows him. You know, it's like he's alone in the universe, and that's what you could get from Moaning at Midnight or something you could get from Howlin' Wolf's music, too.
We're going to wrap it up with Peter Gronick and Sam Phillips and Sun Records after the news with David Jennings here on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That's a little bit of Rocket 88 there, and we're talking to Peter Gronick, the author of Sam Phillips, the man who invented rock and roll. And we're going to pick it up with our friend talking about John Prine in the last session he did with Sam Phillips.
Now, I want to wrap it up. This has been great. Again, for local audiences, but it's so relevant because it was Sam's last session. Talk about the John Prine, recording John Prine at Phillips Recording Studio there in Memphis.
Well, John Prine, again, was somebody who I think Knox thought that Sam might like his voice because it was so bad, and that's what Sam heard in John Prine, the same thing that he heard in Howlin' Wolf. He says, you know, your voice is so bad, I think I might be able to do something with it, you know. But what he, you know, when he meant bad, it's sort of like saying that cat is bad. Well, he meant it was good, you know. He meant that in ugliness is beauty, and, you know, or as Bob Dylan said, there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. I mean, Sam had an ingrained sense of paradox, and it operated in his aesthetic as much as it did in his real life. But the thing with John Prine was he was just determined to get out of John Prine, you know, everything he had to give. And, I mean, the funny thing is, on the album that I put together, you know, it's a 55-track, 2-CD, 3-LP album with the same title as the book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. And
is that out yet? Is that out?
Oh, yeah. It's on Yep Rock. No, I mean, everybody within sound of our voices should definitely have a copy, or at least steal a copy. But the song that I put on there was How Lucky Can One Man Get, which became almost the theme song of the last part of Sam's life. I mean, you could be walking along with him and he would start reciting it or singing it or humming it. And I think it exemplified in it. It's a sunny song of nostalgia, I guess. Or, you know, it's hard to say. I wouldn't characterize it, but it's a beautiful song. But what he was looking for from Prine in that instance was this purity of tone, this just sort of simplicity. There's just nothing extraneous to it at all. And it's almost like a folk song. It's maybe much more in keeping with Prine's, with a lot of John Prine's earlier work. But then with Saigon, you know, he blew up an amp in the echo chamber. And he wanted to create the sound, you know, it's about post-traumatic stress syndrome, Vietnam vet, and he wanted to create this sense of, you know, flying fragments, burning fragments of metal flying through the air, something like that. And he had the band and John just do the song slower and slower and slower. You know, can you do it at half speed? Can you do it at a half of half speed? And then he says, now can you sing it with some soul? And then he let them go, as he had with many of his, you know, classic productions for Sun Records. And it's just, you know, it's just wild. I mean, it does have the sense of just doom and cataclysmic doom, maybe. John always described it, and I'm sure he described it to you, as just, you know, fire and brimstone coming out of Sam's eyes, Sam fixing him with that gaze.
Oh, yeah. And I'll never forget that. It was very religious to talk to him. Dan Long, do you know that, now this is in Peter's book, Sam was watching the Cubs when he died, right? Right at the last minute, he was watching a Cubs
game?
That's
right. Yeah, he would have been watching the Cardinals, but he couldn't get the broadcast. But you know how much Sam loved baseball.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
He just absolutely, it was one of the great mutual discoveries. That was, I think, when finally some of his reserve broke down, when he realized how much I love baseball, how much I love playing baseball, and we started talking about it. And, you know, then he started talking about someday we'd meet up in something like heaven and, you know, toss a ball around. I mean, it was just like the most extraordinary revelation, because I asked Jerry Phillips one time, I said, so did Sam used to play catch with you when you were a kid? And Jerry said, well, you know, Sam, he had his own special way of, you know, doing things. So he had all these trick pitches he had, and all these trick ways of, you know. But I talked with Sam's cousin, his nephew, his favorite nephew, Philip Darby, in Florence last week. And he'd said this before, but he said if Sam could have done anything in life, the one thing he would have most liked to have done would have been to have been a professional ball player.
Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, How One Man Discovered, Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley, and how his tiny label, Sun Records of Memphis, revolutionized the world. It's on Little Brown. And plug that CD again. I did not know that was out.
Yeah, no, the CD is same title. The title is just Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. That's the title for the book and the CD. But it's on Yep Rock Records. We got 55 tracks, 2 CDs, 3 you know, if you're into vinyl, 3 LPs, and it's an idiosyncratic selection. I mean, I sequenced it. You know, sequencing is a dirty word now, and in a time of shuffle, of course, but downloads. But basically, I sequenced it across all genres, across chronology, just with the idea that, you know, Howlin' Wolf could run up against Johnny Cash, could run up against whoever, you know, Little Junior Parker. I mean, it was with the idea of getting a feel. Sam's belief with Ike Turner, with Howlin' Wolf, or even with a song like She's Dynamite, but his belief in particular with with Rocket 88 and Wolf, was that these songs were going to cut. In 1951, he's in the newspaper saying how this song, Rocket 88, is not going to be confined to a particular segment of the populace. It's not going to be confined to a category, which was then called race music or R&B. This is going to reach all people. This has the capacity. And Sam said much later, but I think he believed it just as much at the time. He said to me, he may have said it to you, about how he thought Howlin' Wolf could have been just as big as Elvis Presley,
yeah,
with white kids as well as black. And I can't quite see that, but as Sam said it, it must be true. But that was his vision back in 1950 when he opened the studio. That was his vision in 51 when he had the first number one hit with Rocket 88, was that the music was going to break down the walls of segregation.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Peter. And I'm going to see you before April. I'll buy you some lobster bisque at Skull's Rainbow Room. You're going to love it. It's just really, I'm really excited about this place. We're posting a story with our segment. I wrote 3,000 words on it, so check it out when it comes out this weekend.
All right. Well, I'm counting on this visit. You know?
Okay.
And you've made this vow. You've made this pledge to millions of listeners. And every one of them is going to hold you accountable.
Okay. Thanks, Peter. Good luck.
Okay, thanks.